People are missing in North America and beyond. Where are they? What happened to them? In a moment, David Politis joins us again as we talk about missing 411, North America and beyond. This is perhaps one of the most perplexing, incredible stories I've ever heard, and we'll talk with you about it in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Politis with us, of course, author of Missing 411, North America and Beyond. Let me tell you a little bit about David. Receiving his undergraduate and graduate degrees from the University of San Francisco, he has a background that includes 20 years in law enforcement and senior executive positions in the technology sector. Back in June of 2012, David was an invited speaker at the 2012 National Association of Search and Rescue's annual conference. The presentation was on the findings of the Can-Am project that were detailed in his book, Missing 411. The packed room at the convention center heard David give a detailed overview of the 28 clusters of missing people and the associated elements found within these clusters. He has been on Coast to Coast before, back by popular demand, with a truly, David, incredible, incredible story. Welcome to the show again, Dave.
Thanks a lot, George. I appreciate that.
Tell me a little bit more of your background and how you got involved in this Can-Am Missing Project.
Well, originally, when I was in police work, I worked a few missing persons cases. There were two of us from San Jose Police that were sent to the Pauley Class case on a mutual aid request. We happened to know the FBI investigator that was the head of that investigation at the time. He requested us. We went up and... So that's my law enforcement background on it, but I happened to be in a national park 3, 4, 5 years ago now, and researching some other items. And during that time, I was talking to contractors inside the park, not park employees. And I came back to an off-site location to my room, and about 7, 8 o'clock that night, I got a knock on the door, kind of strange. I opened the door, and there were a couple of plainclothes people standing there. And they stated that they were park employees, they knew who I was, and they had a story that they wanted to tell me, and if I had time, could I listen to them?
Hmm.
I thought it was kind of strange, but I let them in, ended up talking for a couple hours, and they laid out a scenario where each of them had worked at parks for the last 15 to 20 years. They'd spent considerable time at these parks, and they had assisted in search and rescue on missing people. And what bothered them was that at the front end, there was a significant amount of publicity about the missing persons cases. The search went on usually from 5 to 10 days. At the end of the 10th day or at the end of the search, everything stopped. Publicity stopped, searching stopped, investigation stopped, nothing else happened. And they stated that there appeared to them to be an inordinate amount of missing people inside the parks that they worked at, and because there was never any follow-up about it, it concerned them. They knew that I had an investigative background. They knew I had written a couple books in the past. They said that I had a good name in the media. And they said, Dave, we need somebody with some credibility and integrity to really look into this. And would you do it? I said, hey, I'll make a call tomorrow morning. I'll talk to a couple law enforcement guys and let's see what happens. They stated that they didn't want any other involvement. They trusted that something would happen and they left and that was it. That next morning, I made a call to a couple of different law enforcement people I knew. And I asked them to check 3 separate parks and see if there were a significant amount of missing people under strange circumstances. And within an hour, I got a call back from each of them saying, there is something really weird you just hit on.
Jeez.
And that kind of started at the time a focus on Yosemite National Park. At the time, I was living in San Jose, California. It was one of the closer national parks, had a lot of visitors. It was a known location, and we could get to the archives pretty easily for the county that Yosemite sits in. And right from the get-go, George, it became blatantly obvious that something highly unusual was going on there.
This is a strange story, David. You know, I've heard you, and you, of course, for the benefit of new listeners, you've been on with our weekend colleague, George Knapp, talking about this. But again, for the benefit of those who have not heard you before, David, give us an overview on the research, how long you've been doing it, and how many people missing are we talking about? And I know you're projecting in some cases, but what's the number?
So the number, we have a solid number of over 1,100 right now. And I want the people to understand that these are not normal missing persons cases. These aren't cases where maybe somebody was depressed and wanted to fall out of society. These aren't water-related deaths. These aren't issues where there's a possible kidnapping or a murder by someone they know. Those are exclusionary issues that we have and we won't investigate. These are highly, highly unusual. And after working at this for 4 years and probably looking at over 3,500 or 4,000 cases, there are certain elements in these disappearances that start to fall out. And that has set a criteria for us of what we look at and what we'll study.
Is there a time span here, David, for these cases?
That's a great question. And early on, we made a determination as a research group that that wouldn't be a factor. And in fact, if you look at history, there's a reason we study history in school, is that maybe that will give us a backdrop of what's happened in that specific location in the last 150 or 200 years if we could work it backwards from that point. And many of the locations, we've gone back 120, 125 years and found the set of criteria that we have fit disappearances in that area during that span.
Just a bizarre story. We're going to get into some of these cases that you've looked at, but as we get more into the background, are we talking then primarily parks in North America, or are we talking inner cities? Where are we here?
So these are all rural disappearances, no inner city disappearance.
Okay.
Here's some of the criteria. With 90-plus percent of these cases, maybe 95%, there's bad weather associated with the disappearance, and we're talking about multiple different types of bad weather. For some reason, we can't explain this, berries are associated with the disappearance. The people come back eating berries. They disappear while they're picking berries, something like that. And then the really odd one is a vast, vast majority of the young children that disappear were with canines at the time they disappeared. And then the one that really will throw people is that 98, maybe 99% of the time, bloodhounds and tracking dogs that are brought to the scene will not be able to find a scent on these people.
That's unusual.
It is. Many
Very
times,
unusual.
Many times they'll be brought to the location they were last seen. They'll give the dog something to scent. The dog will walk in a circle and lay down. Sometimes the dog will walk back to the master, sit down on its hindquarters, and look at the master. And it's been described to me as though the canine is either afraid or there is no scent to track. And as somebody who's worked with these tracking canines through my years in law enforcement, these dogs live to track. They get excited, they want to be involved, and these dogs just simply can't find it or don't want to do it.
Wow.
95 to 98% of the disappearances occur in the afternoon. In the East Coast, swamps and briar patches play a huge role in these disappearances, and I'm not talking about kids drowning in swamps. I'm talking about them being found in the middle of swamps where searchers sometimes can't understand how they got there.
Now, when you say being found, are they dead or alive?
So in a percentage of these cases, the victims are found. They're normally not found by the search and rescue people. They're many times found by secondary searchers after the primary search fails. And then in the truly bizarre sense, we just got done tracking this. There is a very large percentage of these cases where the victim, when they are found, they're found in an area that had been searched sometimes as many as 100 times. Sometimes they're found semi-conscious, unconscious, on a trail that the primary searchers have walked out every morning in the last 14 days.
Jeez. As if they're brought back there later on at a certain time.
That's what many searchers say.
Of the percent found, how many are dead?
Probably of the percent that are found, 50%.
50%. And we're going to get into what some of the people have said, those who have been found, if they have any memory at all about this.
Correct.
Or do they? Do they have any memory of what's happened to themselves?
They have a very, very tight frame of a memory. The vast majority don't know what happened to them, or they're found 99% are found semi-conscious or unconscious, and when they're brought back to their parents, most of the time when they're questioned, they'll say, I don't know, I just woke up there, or I don't remember anything. And sometimes the parents have said that they feel as though the child doesn't want to talk about it, and they're told by the psychologist or by law enforcement not to push them.
Huh. And when you talk, when you just mentioned parents, to me that means most of these people who disappear are children. Is that accurate?
The vast majority we found are between 20 months and 12 years.
That's unusual.
But then there's an older segment of that that's between, say, 74 and 85. But the predominant age group that's in the woods, meaning people between the ages of 22 and 50, they disappear, and sometimes they meet the profile, but they don't disappear in the numbers that we're talking about for the very young and the very old.
David, have we ruled out the very young and the very old simply wandering off, the old having Alzheimer's disease, the young being kids who have no idea what they're doing, and by the time they realize that they're missing, they're lost, they don't know how to get back?
And of course, that's where our minds want to go on these issues. They want to have that rational aspect to why this is occurring. But when you question the parents, the predominant statement is, they were right next to me, or they were right behind me, and they disappeared. Well, being a parent, as we are, you know when your child disappears, what's the first thing you do? You call out to them. Hey, Johnny, where are you? Hey.
Oh, yeah. And I remember, David, as a parent of young kids at the time, I would not let them out of my sight. I mean, I could not relax wherever we went on vacation, whether it was a beach or the zoo or anywhere, because I had to keep my eye on my kids. It's just a phobia of mine. And, are you saying that if I blinked, they might be gone?
The statements coming from the parents almost indicate that it happens very, very quickly.
My God.
And then the subsequent reaction to that you'd expect, even if you hadn't looked at your child in 20 or 30 seconds, if they disappeared, they're not going to get out of yelling distance.
No, they're not. Not at all. Now, what about the attire? What are the kids wearing or the people wearing at this time? Does that have anything to do with this?
There is more bright-colored clothing associated with a disappearance than anything else. But then, since you brought up the clothing issue, there is a very discerning aspect to that that will come out and just hit you right in the face. And that is that the vast, vast majority of these people, adults or children, when they're found, they're missing shoes or clothing or both. Now, let me premise this, that the people that are missing the clothing, in a vast majority of those instances, the clothing is found in a very short distance from where they disappeared, or when they're found, it might be a warm day, there's no issue of hypothermia, and the clothing is never found, and the shoes are never found. But the interesting part of this is that when the kids are found miles and miles and miles away without shoes, in the reports and in the doctor's statements afterwards that we've reviewed, there's never any statement about bloody feet or cuts on the feet that would be subsequent to that lengthy of a walk.
Have any of these missing children been reported to have been molested?
And that's a common question that we're asked. One of the things you have to remember is that the search and rescue people are not criminal investigators, and 99.99% of the time, they're not thinking criminal. They're great people, 90% of them are volunteers, and they're out there under the good graces of themselves looking for these lost people and hoping to find them. When they find them, they don't think of that location as a crime scene, and they don't think about the victim being a victim of a crime. Now, when the victim's brought back to, say, a hospital, those doctors, I'm going to guess 95% of the time, aren't thinking criminal either. They're just thinking general welfare. And every report I've ever read subsequent to that only dealt with their physical condition related to how they were missing. Never have I read a statement that they were physically molested.
What regions of the country in these parks seems to be more predominant for these disappearances?
Well, again, we're following the set of specific criteria. And the number one cluster of disappearances anywhere in the world is Yosemite.
Huh. Highest percent of all of them.
It's not even close. There's probably over 40 or 45 cases now out of Yosemite alone.
That's unbelievable. All right, let's go through the criteria piece by piece for a moment here, David. And then we'll continue doing that in the next half hour. Then the next hour, I want to talk with you about some of these specific cases. And then I'm sure a lot of people have questions for you as well. The bad weather associated with the disappearance. How significant, in your opinion, is that?
So initially, our thought was bad weather happened to hit after the person disappeared. That hindered search and rescue finding tracks, finding a scent trail, etc. So that was the reason of the association. But the more we went on, the more people would say, you know, the weather was great when we started, and it was like within minutes after my boy disappeared, weather hit, and then it just decimated the area for weeks. And specifically, there's a case we'll talk about later tonight, Dennis Martin at the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That is exactly what happened. Perfect weekend. Dennis disappeared. Within hours, it started raining and raining hard. It rained that way for 2 weeks.
And almost as if some force is making this happen?
Well, a lot of people have written to us who have read the books stating that, you know, it seems as though something is controlling the weather in association with the disappearance. And as a way to cover its trails, it's causing the weather to go bad. That's what they say.
We're with David Politis and his book, of course, Missing 411. David Berries, tell me this one now.
So this one's interesting. There's a section in one of the books, Missing 411 books, I wrote specifically about berry pickers who disappeared. And there are a lot of people in Canada that went berry picking and disappeared. And there's many in the United States as well. And the vast majority of these people are never found, which is very strange because the amount that is allocated to the search for these people is enormous, and they can't understand why they can't find them. Now, we're talking about blueberries, blackberries. The number one berry associated with the disappearance where the person will never be found is a huckleberry.
A huckleberry?
A huckleberry.
This is bizarre. Well, that's one thing we should never go pick then, I guess. Have we ever had reports of two or more people disappearing together, a group?
There have been, and those disappearances are some of the most well-documented and unusual anywhere. There's two people that are grad students from UC Berkeley that disappeared in Yosemite, and we can talk about it later, the specifics behind it, but the words that the parents use a vast majority of the time on these cases isn't that their kids are missing. It's that our kids were abducted. And these are in reports and news articles. And normally, every time I've ever worked a case, the people just say, you know, well, we can't find our kid. But they don't bring up kidnapping or abduction in the middle of a case where it's in the middle of nowhere.
Not at all. David, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more about this very strange, strange episodes of missing people, missing 411. David Politis with us. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it sure is. And let me tell you, last week was the highest week of viewership for our television show Beyond Belief ever in almost a year and a half that we've been doing the program. So thank you, all of you who have been taking a peek at it. You can too. You can look at it for free. There's a free sampling of the program. You can sign up for it by going to beyondbelief.com and just enjoy yourself. You can look at more than just the show, all the other self-help videos that are available from that network for you. Simply go to beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with David Politis as we talk about his work, Missing 411. David, so we're talking about two or more people disappearing, and that does happen.
Does happen. It's probably not as unusual as we initially thought. but it does, and it's hard to say if they went simultaneously or if one went and then the other went. Many of the times, the pairs are never found. If they are found, sometimes they're found tens of miles apart, and therein lies an unusual part of the story that's hard to rectify in our minds about how it could happen.
That is strange. I mean, was it like they got picked up and dropped off?
That's been brought up before, too. Yes.
My God. Okay, so now let's go to the animals again. The dogs specifically, the bloodhounds that can't find the scent. They walk in circles. They act as if they don't want anything to do with this. I've got to tell you, knowing bloodhounds and watching some police work in the past, David, that's highly unusual. These animals are trained. They're darn good at what they do. For them not to be able to pick up a scent, that's absolutely strange.
So when I spoke at the NASA Search and Rescue Conference, at the end of the talk, there were probably 50 or 60 people in a line that were search and rescue professionals from throughout the world that wanted to talk. And the general statement that kept coming was, I was saying what everybody knew but didn't want to talk about.
And that was?
That there are strange disappearances in the woods. Search and rescue people know about it. They can't explain it, but no one's come forward to put the pieces together in a way we have to show that it's an international issue.
So it is happening all over this planet in record numbers, no doubt. And later, but you know, we're not going to leave you hanging, folks. We're going to talk about some possibilities here that David has looked at. We don't have any definitive answers yet, David. That's the strange thing, too, about all this, isn't it?
Well, a lot of people have asked me over the years, what's our opinion? And what I tell them is that there's a lot of people out there that shoot from the hip. And what you're going to get from us is nothing even close to that. Because unless I can stand up and definitively state what it is, then I don't want to be embarrassed later on, and I don't want my credibility or integrity attacked and saying, what a fool this guy was.
Yeah, exactly. All right, afternoon disappearances. You would think that if somebody was going to disappear by some kind of means, that whoever or whatever was doing it would do it at night. Afternoon disappearances, how come?
Well, and the nighttime issue could be possible, but you got to remember that most of the people on the trail are getting off the trail when it's dark. So there may not be the numbers on the trail at night to be victimized. Why the afternoon, and predominantly it's between 2 and 6 p.m., but generally the overall view is between noon and 7. But I would say that we have no idea why it's the afternoon.
Swamps and briar patches again. Creepy places, to be sure. What's happening there?
So as I stated earlier, there are a number of people, namely young children, that are found in the middle of the swamp. They don't know how they got there. Searchers many times have to wade through the swamp to get to that location. Many times in reading past searches, search and rescue people will say, yeah, the dog walked up to the scent, stopped. We never found anybody. The person was never found. And I'm thinking at the time, they should have went right into the middle of that swamp because there's a good chance that whoever was missing is right in the middle of that. Now, why? I don't know. But water is one of those predominant elements that we see in these disappearances. Many times when people are found, they're found in or near a dry creek bed, a river bed. And what we get back from people after they read this is that, well, that's a good place for somebody to lay down or somebody to be placed because no one's going to find any tracks there, which is true.
When the people are found, does it seem that whoever put them there, or however they got there, they want people to find them?
Yes, I think that's true. And the reason I say that is that we're working on the statistic right now about people that are found in locations previously searched. It's over 100. There's hundreds that are found in a location where search and rescue has spent considerable time. And we've all talked about this as a group. There is no way the search and rescue people have missed these people because they're walking through the area, working grid patterns, yelling, screaming, looking, bringing dogs through. The person isn't there. Somehow or another, they show up later.
And the people are found, you know, semi-conscious, unconscious, acting, I assume, in almost like a zombie-like state?
I've seen pictures of some of the kids that are found, and there is a distinct look. Their eyeballs are so wide open, it's almost like a deer-in-the-headlights look.
So they've seen something that may have frightened the living daylights out of them, David.
I don't know. That's a great question. And one of the other things we're always asked about is that, Dave, why don't you work with these people and put them through some type of regression hypnosis to find out really where they're at? And early on in this research, we're smart enough to know that we go out and we're trying to find the minefields before we step into this area. So we went about it the smart way, and we talked to some search and rescue groups, and we talked to some missing persons groups to ensure that we didn't tread on any area that would get us a bad name in that arena. And the common response was, is that if you're going to write a book, don't go out and interview the victims, because if you write about their story, they're going to feel as though they're victimized a second time. Now, if the victims come to you or the family comes to you, that's a different scenario. And that is just starting to happen within the last 6 months.
A little bit like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, where the two killers were very willing to talk about what they did and why they did it.
Yeah.
Now, have any of these people who have been found been tested for any specific kind of narcotic or drug that might have been forced into them?
Again, a good question, and one that I wouldn't know. So, again, we got to keep this mindset out there that when the doctors or when the people find these individuals, they're not thinking like you and I are talking right now. They're just thinking it's a normal disappearance. The boy, the teenager, the adult disappeared on their own, and we just were lucky enough to find them. So none of this testing, none of this investigation on the part of what really happened ever occurs. It's like
Tell
the perfect storm for whatever's happening.
And you know, again, missing clothes, missing shoes, they're not talking, their eyes are wide open, like you just said. To me, and I'm not a professional investigator, to me, they've seen something. They're in shock almost.
Yeah, that could be. One of the elements that I haven't stated that comes out when the doctors do an examination and the victim gets to the doctor within a reasonable period of time, and this is an odd one, is that the victim usually has some type of low-grade fever, but no ailment that the doctors can find. And that's stated in the reports or in the news articles. And again, if we hadn't all read thousands of reports, that wouldn't come out. I'm not sure what it means, but I've written about it in the books.
You've been looking at, 34 locations? That's your cluster map?
We're up over 40 now.
40. And it doesn't stop. People are coming to you, I assume?
You know, just lately, some parents of some of the victims have heard about what we're doing and said, look at this, look at these news articles about my child and tell me what you think. And more times than not, it comes back as a positive in that it's something that we need to look at.
Originally, a couple park workers came to you with these stories. What are they saying now? What seems to be the general consensus of park workers about these disappearances?
George, you just hit the nail on the head. I could talk about this topic for hours, but I'll keep it short.
No, you're with me for two more.
So when we started to determine that Yosemite and Crater Lake and a few other national parks on the West Coast seemed to have an inordinate amount, we started to send a series of Freedom of Information Act requests for data on the missing people. Now, understand that most large police departments in the United States, most medium-sized police departments in the United States have a website, and on the website, there's a section about missing people. Many times in that section about missing people, there are photos and a short dissertation about the person missing. You will not find anything on any national park website about missing people. It's as though the issue doesn't happen. And when we FOIA'd the National Park for data, we got a response back that stated that they didn't keep any data on missing people. They have no records, and they have no ledgers. So we, being law enforcement guys, thought there was something semantical in our FOIA request, and we submitted another one with different wording. This time, a lawyer called us back from the National Park Service asking why we wanted the data, which, according to the Freedom of Information Act, that cannot be a determining factor in your request and if it's granted. And it was the very unusual phone call. I explained that we were doing research on missing people and we just wanted data points. Since this was occurring in their parks, we knew that they had it and we just wanted to get it. The attorney said that they didn't keep any data on missing people. None of the national parks, monuments, or the 400 locations in the system kept anything about missing people. And they relied, and I'll quote this, on the institutional memory of their employees to assist in any knowledge base on missing people.
Jeez.
So
they don't want anything to do with this.
Well, it even gets stranger. So, again, using their quote of institutional memory, that meant to me and the group that this could be readily gotten information from their employees. So there's a section in under the Freedom of Information Act that if you're a published author, you get an exemption from any fees associated with FOIA. So we asked them to put together a list of missing people from Yosemite. And we asked for the exclusion based on the published work I had. Again, the attorney calls me back and said, we're not going to abide by that. And this is something we've never heard. We can't find it anywhere. And if it exists, I want somebody to tell me. But he said that my books weren't in enough public libraries to qualify for that exemption.
Oh, come on. Really? Unbelievable.
But they stated that if we wanted that list from Yosemite and we wanted them to put it together, it would cost us $34,000.
They're scaring you away.
Oh, it gets worse. So I said, well, let's say I want it from the entire system. I want missing person lists from
all over
each
the place.
One. Right. And they came back 2 weeks later, and they said that would be $1.4 million.
My gosh. Do you think the reason they don't want it publicized is because they don't want people to stop coming to the national parks?
Again, possibly. But, again, the list we've put together with just the parks that we've been able to dig into those archives and the limited response we're getting from the National Park Service, the numbers in some of these locations are pretty scary. And it's not specifically and only just the numbers. It's the type of disappearances that are reflected inside those locations.
If you had a child, David, I don't know if you do or not. I'm not going to ask you. Well, I guess I will. Do you have a child?
I have two kids in college.
Okay. All right. If they were smaller, at this point with what you know about these parks, would you take them to a national park?
Oh, I would, but I've always been a guy like you, George. They're right next to me. I'm holding them. They're on my shoulders. They're not getting out of my view.
The people who have disappeared, based on the parents who have discussed this or other people who have discussed this, is there any pattern of anything unusual? I mean, do they simply say, well, there's no question the kid was wandering around and, you know, I took my eye off him for 10 minutes. Do they say anything like that?
I'll give you a brief story. Rocky Mountain National Park, 1938. A boy and his family are at the park walking up a river. The parents describe the boy, Alfred Bielarts, 6 years old, being right behind them. They walked up the river a short distance. The river was down a short hill, maybe 25, 30 feet away, and he disappeared. Well, the Park Service initially goes to the water and says, well, the boy must have fallen in. And what they did was it was a gigantic effort. They got permission to block the river, and they essentially dammed it upstream, and they searched under every rock and cranny in that river for 2 weeks and didn't find him. Now, uphill from where they were, up a valley, there was a husband and wife coming back from a backpacking trip.
Okay.
They had been in the backcountry for 2 weeks. They didn't know any boy was missing. As they're walking down the valley, they take a rest on a rock, and they hear something 200 feet above them on a cliff. They get out their binoculars, and they see a small boy sitting on a rock on a ledge. And they said, oh, my God, this, whoever the parent is, this kid ought to go to jail because that kid's in a bad area and right. dangerous. And they get upset, and anyhow, they put it away, and they walk down the valley, and they notice that there's 2,500 people all over the park basin. They don't understand what's going on, but the researchers looking for Alfred. They get in their car, and they drive home, and the front page of the Denver Post the next day is a picture of Alfred. And they look at each other, and they say, oh, my God, that's the boy we saw on the cliff.
Ugh.
They drive back to the park, and they give the information to park officials. Park officials treat them as suspects, separate them, and interview them as though they kidnapped the kid.
Ugh.
This went on for a couple hours until they finally realized, wow, these people are telling the truth. We apologize. Can you show us again where they found the boy or where they saw the boy? And they pointed out on a map, and it's an area called Devil's Nest.
Oh.
It's in an area that would take you and me crawling on our hands and knees a good solid day to get to. It's about 3,500 feet above from where he disappeared, and in an area really nobody goes to because it's godforsaken. They sent 20 park rangers with carabiners and pitons. They worked their way in there, and they looked for 2 days. They never found Alfred. He was never found. But that's the sort of story that is in the books that is so far beyond a normal disappearance, it's ridiculous.
Yet they had him. They had him in their sight. They could have saved the kid at that moment, huh?
Well, I don't think the people that saw him could have, because I don't think they, in their right mind, thought that they could ever get up into that location.
See, I would have reported it right away. I would have said, there's a little kid up there. There's nobody around him. What's he doing up there?
Oh, right, yes.
They didn't think of doing that.
No, I think, you know, normal people that just kind of minding their own business and didn't want to get involved until they saw his picture in the paper.
Probably thought his parents were up there watching him or something.
I'm going to guess, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
And the fact, well, I guess it's possible, David, if somebody, you know, dies up there or something happens, an animal's going to drag them off. And, you know, again, next hour we'll get into all these various possibilities, but this is strange. Does this scare you at all, knowing what you know?
It does, because, let's say on the Bielarts case, when you start to look at that area under a microscope, there have been two other little boys that form a triangle in that region that have disappeared. Bielarts has never been found, and there's a second boy 14 miles away that disappeared under equally unusual circumstances that was also never found. And it's part of that Rocky Mountain National Park cluster of disappearances. And it disturbs me because I think that the Park Service has got to know this is going on, and they're not telling the public.
Do you think they know what's going on?
Well, earlier this year, I was at a national park with another friend, and we happened to hear a conversation that was going on between four older gentlemen in a satellite office of the Park Service. And they talked as though they had intimate knowledge.
Hold on there, David. I want to get right back with you on that. When we come right back, David Politis with us as we talk about missing 411 North America and beyond. I've got to tell you, this is a scary, riveting story of disappearances. We'll be back.